Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this May 2010 Science News Update. I'm your very tired host, Jim Campanella. The regular school year ends this week, and so I have a very short respite before I teach my first summer class next week. I'm trying to fit in doing this recording before my month of insanity starts during that class. Let's just get started. One of the dreams of humans is to be able to alter our bodies, make ourselves stronger or faster instantly, or at least over a very short time. Certainly there are plenty of SF stories that use that theme of short-term body alteration as a cornerstone. Authors from Jack Chalker to John Varley have exploited the idea over and over again. Imagine being able to run a marathon tomorrow with no training. I cannot readily imagine doing that myself. Although I'm in pretty good shape, I would literally die in the first several miles if forced to run a long race, simply because my body has not been trained for it. Even though I get weekly workouts in the dojo of which I'm a member, that is not the right type of training for a long, arduous race. I make that joke about the marathon and not being able to go from being a couch potato to a runner in a day, and for humans, that's pretty accurate. We can't do that. However, there are species upon this Earth who can. A new study from Dr. Steve Morris's lab at the University of Bristol describes one such species. His paper was published this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology. Christmas Island red crabs spend months hunkered down and inactive in burrows, waiting for the monsoon season to come every year. As soon as the rains hit, they're off on a marathon, marching across the island for up to 12 hours a day to the beaches where they mate and reproduce. First of all, let me say that the motivation for sexual reproduction seems to be one of the strongest for any higher animal on the face of the earth. I refer you to the entire panoply of Porky's or American Pie movies. Second, the physiology and development that is transpiring in these crabs is nothing short of amazing. They must make major changes to their muscle composition over a very short time of a day or two to switch from muscle-suited to anaerobic short-term sprinting, which they use while lazing around the inland, to aerobic high-endurance muscles needed to sustain that coastal march. In short, they have to have the ability to completely reorganize their muscle structure while actually on the run. For his experiments, Morris collected leg muscles from crabs while they were in the middle of their migrating marathon, and then he returned 6 months later to collect muscles from the animals during the dry season when they were just relaxing. Morris isolated the mRNA from each set of muscles. For those of you who don't remember, mRNA, messenger RNA, is the code molecule that is transcribed from the DNA of genes and then translated to make proteins. It's an intermediate messenger molecule. Scientists can use the presence of those messages to determine what proteins are being made in cells. And if you know what proteins are being made, you can determine if there are any differences between the genes that are being turned on and transcribed during the crab's monsoon migration and those that are transcribed when the crabs are just inactive during the dry season. Well, after months of building a library from the mRNA molecules from both tissues and analyzing the expression levels of many genes, the team finally saw that there were dramatic differences between the migrating and inactive crab muscles. It was not surprising to them that the majority of the genes expressed in the muscles encoded for muscle proteins. There's lots of muscle proteins. There's actin, which forms part of the muscle's contractile unit, and then there are others like troponin and tropomyosin, which regulate muscular contraction. And these were all different in the two types of muscles. When the team took a closer look at the versions of the genes that were expressed, they could see that the couch potato, dry season crab muscles were tuned to short anaerobic sprints, while the muscles of the crabs that were migrating during the monsoon were aerobic, extremely resistant to fatigue, and ideal for the crab's hellish journey. The proteins involved in muscle reconstruction were more abundant in the migrating crab legs, and their comparative upregulation was consistent with the remodeling of leg muscles for the migration in the wet season. The conclusion was that the crab mussels undergo a dramatic change in gene expression, and they are ready for the migration to the coast. That is the cool part. Horrible part is that Dr. Morris did not live to see his work published. He was knocked off his bicycle by a car on the way into his lab about a year ago and died later from his injuries. According to one of his co-authors, he never even got a chance to see the reviewer's comments on the crab paper, which came in the day he was in the accident. I guess that the theme of the story is that you never know when your time is going to come. Onwards. The next story is about an article that appeared at the end of April in the journal Nature. The work was performed by the lab of Dr. Stephen Kingsmore, a geneticist at the National Center for Genome Resources in Santa Fe, New Mexico. One of the concepts that I first teach to genetics classes is the idea that even though identical twins have the same genetic sequence, they are often not just different, but sometimes very different. These differences can depend on the environment that each twin is exposed to. A simple example is the genetic disease phenylketonuria, in which the affected person cannot digest the amino acid phenylalanine. I'm sure you've all seen the warnings on the sides of diet soda cans for people who have PKU. If exposed to phenylalanine as a baby, the toxins build up in a PKU-affected individual and will cause that person to become mentally disabled. If one twin is exposed to the amino acid while the other is not, then you will have one mentally retarded twin and the other will be perfectly normal. Note, this is when they both have the same genetic makeup. They are identical twins still. Well, just to show you how complicated the effect of the environment may be, a new study from Kingsmore's lab has come up empty-handed after pursuing a genetic explanation for why one identical twin can develop multiple sclerosis while the other one stays healthy. Kingsmore found no trace of what caused the discrepancy in the twins' DNA sequences. He and his colleague also found no smoking gun when they compared the actual levels of gene activity between the sick and the well twin. Now, these may seem like negative results, which often drive scientists to drink, but they are still very important. They indicate that it is not just differences in DNA or gene expression that account for differences in the twins. The differences in phenotype between the diseased and healthy twin must come down to the difference in the environments of the two. Kingsmore says, quote, "Our results point to some novel environmental trigger that must be very important to the disease. We just don't know what that is yet," unquote. For those of you who do not remember, in multiple sclerosis, the immune system goes rogue and attacks and damages the myelin sheath that helps speed electrical communications between nerves. That myelin sheath is a fatty layer that must be present for swift communication. Removal of that layer is the equivalent of scraping the coating from an electrical wire and causing short circuits. In affected people, the damage results in pain and symptoms such as loss of coordination and vision and even loss of memory. Kingsmore's work is very interesting and suggests the start of a search for the mysterious environmental triggers that might be present. However, there are some problems with the study's outcome. First, it is quite a small study. It only examined three pairs of twins. Yes, that's right, just six people. Second, the researchers only studied one type of immune cell known to be involved in multiple sclerosis and no others. There are quite a number of cells involved in the process of inducing MS. They didn't look at those others. And finally, third, as any decent scientist will tell you, the problem with negative results are simply that they are negative. Just because you found nothing does not mean there is nothing to find. You may have found the correct result, or you may just need to look harder. So Kingsmore probably needs to do a boatload more experiments before his findings are generally accepted by the science community at large. Okay, for the next story, get out your copies of the Starship Sofa Omnibus Stories Edition Number 1. Now stare at the cover. Besides that lovely robot caught in ice, the thing that draws your attention in the picture are the Neanderthals. They are beastly and violent-looking, and certainly skirt the edge of any kind of humanity. As modern humans, we are fascinated and horrified by the Neanderthals at the same time. They represent a dead path revolution. a dead end. Homo sapiens survived and our poor, sad cousins did not. Evolution favored us because we are so much more adaptable. Or did it? Are Neanderthals truly dead and gone? I'm serious when I ask that question, and no, I am not auditioning for a Monster Hunter episode. I ask that question with all candor. Are there any living Neanderthals left? Well, the answer is yes and no. See, I never make it easy for you, do I? The answer really depends on what you call living and survived. In the May 7th issue of the journal Science, Dr. David Reich of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard examines this very question. It turns out that Reich's new study of the Neanderthal genome shows that humans and Neanderthals actually interbred. This is a serious breakthrough in our understanding of our genetics, as well as that of Neanderthals. Also, the discovery comes as a serious surprise to researchers who have been searching for genetic evidence of human-Neanderthal interbreeding for years and have found none up to this point. About 1 to 4% of DNA in modern people from Europe and Asia was inherited from Neanderthals, says the paper. Reich says that's a small but very real proportion of our ancestry, and I cannot argue with him. Comparisons of the human and Neanderthal genomes also are helping to reveal how humans evolved to become the sole living hominid species on this planet. Neanderthals lived in Europe, the Middle East, and Western Asia until they disappeared about 30,000 years ago. We thought they just died out, but the more likely explanation, based upon this new data, indicates that humans may not have simply replaced Neanderthals, but assimilated them into the human gene pool. Co-author of the paper, Svante Paabo, of the Max Planck Institute, says, "Neanderthals are not totally extinct. They live on in some of us." So there. My answer of yes and no is justified. Neanderthals are essentially dead, but their DNA is still around and living and reproducing. Apparently, none of this came as a surprise to archaeologists and physical anthropologists. Both have described hybridized ancient skeletons from Europe that had characteristics of both early modern humans and Neanderthals. These skeletons, the social scientists said, were evidence of interbreeding between the two groups. But until the cataloging of the entire Neanderthal genome, genetic studies couldn't find evidence to support their hypothesis. The researchers were surprised to find further that people from China and Papua New Guinea, places where Neanderthals never lived, have just as much Neanderthal ancestry as people from France. At the same time, they found no traces of Neanderthal heritage in the two African groups they studied. That result probably means that interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans took place about 50,000 to 80,000 years ago in the Middle East, as humans were migrating out of Africa to colonize the rest of the world. It's not clear how extensive this interbreeding was. The data are consistent with either a short period with a lot of interbreeding or a long period of little interbreeding. Now, here's one of the problems. Biologists define species as strains of animals or plants that are able to successfully reproduce to give fertile offspring. Since humans and Neanderthals could interbreed, some people question whether the two groups are actually different hominid species. Going by the strict definition, the answer appears to be no. This new study suggests that many humans had a Neanderthal great-great-great-great-great, etc. grandfather. It may be impossible to talk about them as them anymore. As one researcher put it, Neanderthals are us. For the last story of the night, I have a psychology study from the latest issue of the journal Biopsychosocial Medicine. The study was performed by Dr. Kurt Kropke at the Center for Chronobiology in the Psychiatric University Clinics in Basel, Switzerland. Dr. Kropke reports on the relationship between cold hands and feet and insomnia and suppressed anger in women. Now, I would not have thought those rather disparate elements would have any relationship to each other at all, but Dr. Kropke tends to disagree. The aim of his study was to test the hypothesis of whether stereotypic feminine gender socialization, That is, little girls being forced to play with dolls, wearing dresses, washing dishes, or changing babies, is related to anger suppression, which in turn could affect sleep and the temperature of the extremities. When I first read this, my first impression was, what in the blue blazes is this nut going on about? But I wanted to give him a chance, and I read the paper, and, well, by the time I was finished with it, I was certain that he was nuts as a bag of planters. 148 Swiss women were questioned in large surveys on their suppressed anger, cold fingers and toes, and insomnia. Further questions were included that, quote, employed a gender power inventory and estimated the degree of gender-specific power expression explicitly within these women by stereotypic feminine or male attribution, unquote. They then did statistical analyses to determine whether there were any correlations among these factors. The results? Well, a significant correlation was found from stereotypic feminine attribution to suppressed anger and prolonged insomnia. Additionally, a further indirect correlation was found from anger suppression to cold extremities. In contrast, any women who had stereotypic male attributes did not show the suppressed anger, but were significantly associated with outwardly expressed anger. So if I understand this right, women who are brought up feminine in a stereotypical fashion do not express anger. They suppress it and will not be able to sleep. Okay, I kind of understand that. But further, they will have cold fingers and toes? While women who show more masculine-type behavior and do not suppress anger will have no trouble sleeping and will have warm fingers and toes. Am I reading this correctly? The authors conclude that stereotypic feminine gender socialization may play an important determinant for anger suppression, which consequently can lead to thermal discomfort from cold extremities and insomnia. This entire premise is so inane that I do not even know where to begin with it. First of all, let me say, as someone with a daughter, many girls just naturally drift into the stereotypic feminine gender role. My daughter loves trains and cars almost as much as my son does, but she is also a fashion diva and loves dolls and makeup and Disney's princesses. My wife and I have never pushed her toward any of those things, but she just naturally is drawn to them. I've talked with other fathers who have daughters, and they often say the same thing. No matter how gender neutral they have tried to raise their daughters, they just naturally are drawn to all things feminine just by themselves. It just happens. So am I to understand that this study suggests that girls exposed to stereotypic feminine stuff will engender secret anger toward men, society? What exactly? And worse, that anger will cause them not to sleep and to have cold hands and feet? Well, maybe if the women are Swiss? I have no idea. First, I suggest that Kroeke think twice about self-reported data. Subjective data is always questionable data. Just because someone says they have cold hands does not mean that they do. Show us the physiological data on blood flow and temperature, and perhaps we'll believe it a little more. Second, I swear every girlfriend I ever had as a youth complained about cold hands. Now that is just my experience, but if cold hands in women is quite prevalent, then it is silly to be correlating cold hands with any psychological state, because it is just as likely to be or not depending on that particular psychological state. I chatted with my wife about this. She's a mathematician. When I told her that 30% of women, according to the authors of this study, have cold extremities, she laughed and said that the statistics of the paper are nonsense. If you have such a high population of women with one condition, cold feet, and if there is an equally high population of women with suppressed anger, let's say conservatively 30%, then probability says there will just have to be a population of women who are both angry and have cold feet. The two traits will be independent of each other, but they will appear together in a high enough proportion of the population to appear significant. This is made worse by two other problems with the study. First, the cross-section of the study was not broad at all in terms of ages, 20 to 40, or races. All were white Swiss women. And 148 women is a very small sample population to be making such broad statements as they are making. I kind of like the idea that distal vasoconstriction and cold extremities may have clinical relevance for insomnia, but I am not convinced that these have anything to do with feminine stereotypes and anger suppression. This is why I'm not a psychologist, by the way. It seems so difficult sometimes to not only come up with new psychological hypotheses, but also to support them experimentally. Well, that's all for me from now. As always, take care, watch out for insomniac feminists with cold feet, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.